Welcome to the Quillette Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Kay, a senior editor at Quillette. Quillette is where free thought lives. We are an independent, grassroots platform for heterodox ideas and fearless commentary. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going to quillette.com and becoming a paid subscriber. The subscription will also give you access to all our articles and early access to Quillette social events.
Black people don't need another apology. We need safer neighborhoods and better schools. We need a less punitive criminal justice system. We need affordable health care. And none of these things can be achieved through reparations for slavery. And the obligation of citizenship is not transactional. It's not contingent on ancestry. It never expires, and it can't be paid off. For all these reasons, Bill H.R. 40 is a moral and political mistake. Thank you.
What you just heard was an excerpt from Quillette author Coleman Hughes, as C-SPAN then described him, speaking on the subject of slavery reparations to the U.S. House Committee on the Judiciary on June 19, 2019. At the time, Hughes was still an undergraduate student at Columbia University, but his intellectual star was already on the rise thanks to his writing at Quillette and elsewhere. And it wouldn't be long before he'd start up a popular podcast called Conversations with Coleman, as well as a Substack called Coleman's Corner. During this time, he's carved out a niche as a smart, independent-minded writer and speaker, gaining a substantial media following in the process. But he's also been criticized by some fellow black intellectuals and activists who view his traditionally liberal approach to race and his rejection of grievance-based politics as ideologically off-message. Earlier this month, I interviewed Hughes over Zoom about his new book called The End of Race Politics: Arguments for a Colorblind America. In that book, Hughes harkens back to the values espoused by Martin Luther King and the original 1960s-era civil rights movement, rejecting what he calls the neo-racism embedded within modern progressive orthodoxy. Here's a recording of that interview. Coleman, welcome to the Quillette Podcast. How have you been?
I've been good. It's good to be back.
You look very calm and relaxed. Last time I saw you in person, I think you were in the middle of that whole controversy about reparations. I think you had testified to lawmakers and there was a big blowback on that.
Yep.
Which I remember being like a very stressful time for you.
Yeah, I was probably a lot less relaxed.
It feels weird to say Coleman's just released this big controversial book on race politics. It's a comparatively relaxed time in your life, but I get the sense it is.
No question. I mean, after testifying before Congress against reparations, not only did I have people jeering and booing me in the room, but I had people hissing at me as I walked out of the room, you know, at point blank range. And then I had people, you know, noticing me on the street and so forth. So a book is much more tame than that, in that most people who read it are reading it because they like it. Most people who don't like it don't encounter it. So it's not like my 10 seconds of testimonies being broadcast on cable news for people on the street to hiss at me about. So that was much crazier.
You have some pretty impressive endorsements here on the back. Steven Pinker, Sam Harris, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry. Obviously, you've hit the big time in terms of people noticing what your ideas are. I remember the last time I think we met in person was in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And there was a Quillette event. And then you and I went for shawarma at this place on Queen Street. It was like 1 a.m. I don't remember what we talked about, except that you talked about how you had to get up early the next day to fly somewhere, but you really wanted to go out. And so you weren't worried about this person you called Future Coleman. Future Coleman would be waking up the next morning.
I think I slept on your couch, didn't I?
I just remember the shawarma. I have a very strong memory for fast food. At the time, did you think Future Coleman would be writing a book and Future Coleman would be gushed over by the likes of John McWhorter and Sam Harris?
I definitely knew I was going to write a book. In fact, I probably thought I'd write it sooner than I ended up writing it. You know, it took longer than I expected. So I was definitely aware of Future Coleman's aspirations and already working towards them at that time.
Let's talk a little bit about past Coleman, because apparently past Coleman had an afro, and also past Coleman went to a private school at one point. All these people were trying to touch your head because it was a novelty. And then I think it's 2012 took the opportunity for a three-day trip to some kind of like identity jamboree. You're in high school and you describe your motivations as just like, wow, it's 3 days vacation from school. But in retrospect, as you describe it, it was a kind of proto version of identity awakening camp or something like that. Can you describe what that was like? I mean, this is 12 years ago. It seems like this event was ahead of its time, right?
The fact I was Black and Hispanic and not white was part of the reason they sent me, or they offered to send me, to this three-day excursion. Yeah, when I was in sixth or seventh grade, I had a huge afro, which was became a problem for me, because at this new private school, the white kids and the kids of all races there really were not used to seeing an afro. So it was a novelty to them, and they would almost every day, it seemed, want to touch it. Some would ask permission, some wouldn't. And this was a sharp difference from my prior experience in public school in my town, where it was something like 30% Black kids at that time. So not only were there more Black kids wearing afros, all of the white kids were used to seeing afros all the time. There was nothing particularly interesting to those white kids about seeing an afro. They weren't moved to touch it. Because it was now getting touched all the time, it would ruin the preparation I did on it to get it looking good. It just built up over time as this annoyance that turned into actual exasperation and frustration, to the point where I cried to my parents, like, I don't know how to make these kids stop. The worst part about it is that it actually wasn't mean-spirited or bullying in any way. If it were, I probably would have stood up to the bullies in a more typical sense, but it was actually all out of benign curiosity, which meant for me to shut it down would have required a kind of subtle boundary setting that I wasn't really capable of as a 12-year-old.
Right.
In any event, I ended up getting rid of the afro, had a great time at the school, and I really loved the overall environment of the school in every other way. When I was a sophomore, I believe, or a junior, I forget, my school sent a few kids to what was called the People of Color Conference, which you correctly identify as a kind of identity awakening camp. And it was there that I first heard the concepts of intersectionality, critical race theory, internalized oppression, whiteness, and so on and so forth. Prior to that, I had grown up with the ethic that your race doesn't matter, your skin color doesn't tell you anything deep about who you are, and that treating people on the basis of their race was wrong in every conceivable sense. But at this identity awakening camp, I was taught that my Blackness was essentially a kind of magic, right? That it was like a slice of God inside my soul that white people didn't have. And that message was powerfully attractive to certain kids. Anyway, when I went back to my private school, I kind of wrote this off as a weird little excursion, little exception to my general world, and I never expected to see it again. It's almost like I visited Utah and saw how Mormons lived for a couple of days and then went back to reality. Fast forward to a few years later, I go to Columbia University, and suddenly the ethic I had encountered at that People of Color Conference is the dominant ethic, pushed by the administration, pushed by a subset of the professors, and believed by a passionate minority of the students who kind of set the tone for the culture. When I get to orientation, we do an exercise where the Black kids go in one corner of the room, the white kids go in another, the Hispanic kids go in another, Asians, so on and so forth. Very much the kind of exercise that would have been done at this other conference. The effect was to make me feel far more conscious and self-conscious of my race, what meaning my race might impute into other people's minds. In other words, I'm being asked to go to the Black corner of the room and talk about how I'm a victim of systemic racism. And now I worry that people perceive me that way and people have made this assumption about me, rather than encounter me as an individual who they don't really know anything about, which is how I would like to be encountered. Now they perceive me as the Black guy who's a victim.
I've read countless stories about these kind of exercises where people are invited or instructed to go as part of their so-called affinity group. Asians go to one room and Blacks go to one room and so forth. One thing I've always just been, on a banal level, curious about, once they do that, what do people talk about?
I can tell you what people talk about is they look into their past to find examples of times, some real, some exaggerated, and some imagined, when their Blackness was used against them, when they were treated poorly because they were Black. Most people have something to draw from. Some people have a lot of stories to draw from. And some people have almost none. Yeah. So, you know, every permutation under the sun is real. But what happens is it kind of becomes a group complaining session right? Where you zero in on the aspect of your life, often narrow and unrepresentative moments of your life where you were racially discriminated against, or at minimum, you felt you were. And everyone eggs each other on to make a mountain out of a series of molehills. In many ways, it's the opposite of what a wise therapist would have you do, right? Like a wise therapist or a group therapy session would not be merely a dwelling on the ways in which you've been hurt in your life.
Right, be forward-looking.
Yeah, it would be forward-looking, and it would equip you with the tools to not dwell on what has been done to you, right? It would be a positive, ultimately empowering lesson about how your life is in your own hands, right? And your success is in your own hands, and encouraging what the psychologists call locus of control, which is the sense that you are in control of your outcomes, which is highly correlated with happiness and well-being and so forth. So that's all to say, I'm not against discussing real instances of racism. I've discussed the few real instances of racism in my own life, and I'm not against discussing whole areas in which society may be racist. I am, however, against a toxic dwelling on racism as a kind of a mode of social engagement, put it that way.
This is obviously a tangent, but in my ignorance, I'd always assumed the afro was like a zero maintenance hairstyle.
Why would you assume that?
Because it's round. The Greeks considered the circle the perfect shape.
How do you ensure it's round? But if you sleep on it, if you sleep on your right side and it flattens, how do you ensure? The thing with an afro is that it's not set, right? The same afro can be in 50 different shapes, depending on whether you've slept on it, depending on the day. This is, you know, the concept of a bad hair day applies as much or more to afros than to other hairstyles. Whereas this hairstyle I have is completely zero maintenance. It's going to look the same tomorrow, no matter what happens.
And for those who are listening on audio and not watching,
I just have a fade. Yeah, I have a very, really normal tight fade.
My knowledge of afros, like I grew up in Montreal. Most of my knowledge of black hairstyles came from watching like the Jackson family on TV. Maybe they was just so perfectly coiffed that I just assumed it was always like that.
That's the performance aspect of it. You want to make it look effortless, right?
Very few of my listeners come here for hair care, so I'm going to move on. Going back to your Columbia experience, you talk about meeting all these white students, black students, Hispanic students who, and this is backed up by survey data, sounded more pessimistic about the state of American race relations than your own grandparents who lived through segregation. And then you have a metaphor here. It felt as if I were dropped into a simulation where the real racism dial was set close to zero, but the concern about racism dial was set to 10. How would you navigate conversations with people? You had to get through 4 years of college, and you didn't want, presumably, every social encounter to be a debate. So what was your coping strategy?
Well, I think I used my social intuition to pick my battles. It helped that I was a multifaceted person. I've never been obsessed with politics. You know, I was really interested in music and philosophy. So I had lots of other things to talk about with a typical friend or acquaintance other than politics. And half the time I would just, you know, self-censor and let the conversation move on because I didn't want to debate someone. But the other half of the time I would just try to express my opinion, listen to them, and then disagree with them if they said something that didn't make sense to me. Between that and trying to write for the campus newspaper and eventually writing for Quillette, I did develop a reputation as, in the minds of Columbia kids, I was a conservative, a contrarian, and a dangerous person, essentially. That's all relative because to be a centrist, essentially, is to be perceived as on the far right. I was told by my friends that, you know, people would talk about me behind my back and so forth.
Running for Quillette cost you at least one date, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. There's I matched on Tinder with a girl, and she was a fan of the band that I was in by complete coincidence. So I set her up to be on the guest list to one of our performances. And then at the last second, she reneged because she read one of my Quillette articles.
But just to be clear, your band didn't sing songs about like intellectual heterodoxy, right?
No, it was the Mingus Big Band, the Charles Mingus Big Band, which in fact has some of the best black protest music in American history, I would argue.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
Don't be sorry. It doesn't mean anything to me now.
There's a lot of books that I've read about this cultural moment that tend to be catalogs of terrible things that happened. Like, hey, remember this woman got canceled because of her dress, and remember this professor got hounded off his campus because he said the wrong thing. And it's kind of a catalog of cancel culture episodes that I sort of already know about. Your book is not like that. I mean, you make reference to a few controversies, but you're mostly interested in advancing your own ideas. However, you do linger long enough on a few figures, just long enough to skewer them in a very clever way. One of them is this woman named Robin DiAngelo, who pops up a few times in your book. And you talk about the mode of discourse about race that DiAngelo, who markets herself as this expert in anti-racism, this mode of discourse that she asks people to follow. And you actually take the time to analyze her tips and say, well, she's saying if you're talking to a Black person, if you're a white person talking to a Black person, you shouldn't be passive, but you also shouldn't argue with them, but you also shouldn't make them do emotional labor. And then I think by negative inference, you figure out that really the only way you can follow all her instructions at once is if you just are like very enthusiastic and just every time they say something, you say, wow, that's so true. That sounds so interesting, which is not, it's not really a method of intellectual engagement, right? It's more like a sort of call and response, religious type thing. When you were at Columbia, did you find you were talking to people and they were doing that to you?
Well, there was definitely a certain kind of white Columbia student that was so brainwashed by this kind of...
But they're well-intentioned, right? Like these might be people who come from private schools.
Absolutely.
And they're self-aware that they don't, maybe they didn't know any Black people in their childhood. And maybe in a well-intentioned way, they were trying to do the right thing, right?
Of course. I think all of them were. They were trying to do the right thing. And what people have told them is the right thing is if a Black person is saying something about race, you must agree with it. And you must by definition be ignorant. So you just have to vocally agree with what they're saying, even if it doesn't make sense to you. You have to turn off the skeptical part of your mind.
What if what that Black person is saying to them, as in your case, would be, you're allowed to disagree with me? Like, does that cause a kind of runtime error in their logic?
I mean, there's often logical errors in all of these philosophies, right? The fundamental logical error of postmodernism is that everything is subjective, except for postmodernism, which is itself objectively true. It's a direct contradiction. It doesn't make sense. And this is Foucault. This is countless thinkers that are far more admired than they should be in philosophy. But yeah, it's a contradiction in multiple ways. So for instance, if you're Black and you disagree with me in the exact same way, that disagreement is valid. But if you're white and you disagree with me in the exact same way, then I default to being correct. That can't be true if there's such a thing as objective reality and objective facts. It can't depend on what your skin color is, right? It's not to say that everyone has the same experience. It's not to say that you shouldn't doubt yourself and the narrowness of your own life experience and be curious about how other people's life experiences are different and be curious about how they may know things you don't know. All of that is true, but all of that is quite distinct from saying, because you're white, you have to shut up and listen to me when we talk about race, because you couldn't possibly be right. And I couldn't possibly be wrong. That's positing infallibility. And it's a toxic way to engage as human beings that ought to presume kind of basic equality between us.
So you write in your book that you find race kind of boring, but you don't find identity boring. You acknowledge, or at least argue, that identity is something much more particular than race. You talk about how a majority of Asian people in the United States reject the classification of Asian and they say, well, I'm Korean or I'm Hmong or I'm Japanese or something. And you also talk about the example of your own mother. I lived in New York briefly, but I never heard this. I don't know how to pronounce it.
New Yorican?
It's a play on Puerto Rican, obviously.
Yeah. There's a massive migration from Puerto Rico to New York in the 1950s, such that entire neighborhoods were now, you know, the origin of West Side Story. Why that was recognizable is because there's a whole part of Puerto Rico that transplanted to New York in the middle of the 20th century, and they're called New Yoricans often.
You describe her parents, one as being a minefield here, because you yourself argue that these words are inept.
Yeah.
That her own parents, one was Black and one was white, and that tragically she died of cancer when you were 18. But that, as I understand your understanding of your mother, in a way, she kind of transcended monolithic ideas of race.
Yeah, so she was a product of mixed race parentage. Both her parents were Puerto Rican. One was darker skinned than me, and one was about as light skinned as you. You know, as we know, in Latin America, there is everything from the darkest of the dark to whitest of the white. And so she was a product of that and came out a mix of the two, kind of light brown. And she always described herself as either Puerto Rican, New Yorican, from the South Bronx, She grew up speaking Spanish before she spoke English. She didn't like the term Hispanic, but she would sometimes say Latina and so forth. And I never heard her identify herself as Black. And after she died, I remember once talking to my dad where he kind of casually referred to her as a Black woman. I almost stopped in my tracks. I was like, "You saw Mom as Black?" And it brought the whole thing home to me. You know, I use that as an entryway to the question of what do we mean by race? To what degree is race a social construct? And then I kind of go from there in the book.
Could you explain a little bit, because it occupies several chapters of your book, so I'm asking you to summarize, why you see anti-racism, as the doctrine is now called by progressives, as neo-racism?
So the civil rights leaders of the past, from Wendell Phillips just after the Civil War, down to A. Philip Randolph, Bayard Rustin, Dr. Martin Luther King, and so forth, what they believed in was racism is inherently wrong, and racism is defined as a doctrine of congenital inferiority of a people. That's how Dr. King put it in his final book. They took for granted that racism can be pointed in any direction by any group of people towards any group of people, and they condemned it in every direction, from Black to white, from white to Black, from Asian to Hispanic, and on down. Martin Luther King repeatedly said in his lifetime that Black supremacy would be equally evil as white supremacy. In principle, they believed racism can go in every direction, but it just so happened that the racism that was most present in their lifetime was anti-Black racism, and that's what they were fighting. They believed in a colorblind government, that is a legal regime that cannot distinguish Black from white, as Wendell Phillips put it, who coined the term colorblind, so far as I know. And they believe that when we try to address policy towards the disadvantaged, we should define the disadvantage based on class and socioeconomics, not based on race. That is essentially my view as well. And it comes straight out of the civil rights movement. Since the civil rights movement, there have been various trends on the left which have rejected its core ethos, among them critical race theory and modern anti-racism of the type Kendi and D'Angelo espouse. And they reject the idea that racism can go in all directions, instead proposing that only white people can be racist and only Black people or people of color in general can suffer it. That opens the door to all kinds of policies which discriminate against white people, including policies that happened during COVID, such as triaging emergency aid for restaurants based on race as opposed to financial need, triaging aid for farmers based on race as opposed to financial need, even going as far as to recommend different categories for vaccine priority because certain categories were too white. And all of that's allowed by the idea that white people can't even in principle suffer racism. From Kendi, we get the idea that the state's obligation is in fact to racially discriminate, that laws ought to racially discriminate up until the day when Black people as 13% of the population occupy 13% of every other resource of value, every other domain of value in society, something that has never happened in any society ever, something that has not happened in our own society, even among different white ethnic groups or different Black ethnic groups, where racism can't explain the disparities that are nevertheless large. So we get both this regime of racially discriminatory laws from Kendi, we get a racially discriminatory psychology and social MO from D'Angelo. And all of it stands opposed to what the civil rights leaders of the past envisioned as the healthy end goal for our country, which was a society where I don't treat you differently because you're white, and I ask you not to treat me differently because I'm Black. And we both ask the government to not treat either of us differently because of our race.
We'll get right back to the Quillette podcast following this short commercial break on behalf of an upcoming meetup featuring heterodox thinkers. I'm talking about the 2 days of discussions and debate featured at the inaugural Dissident Dialogues 2024 event in Brooklyn, New York, coming this May 3rd and May 4th. At Dissident Dialogues, you'll be able to listen to leading thinkers such as Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, John McWhorter, Constantine Kissin, Francis Foster, and more, including me. I'll be there, so come say hello. This is a gathering where everyone is part of the conversation. Conservatives, progressives, religious and secular thinkers, left, right, and everything in between. Dissident Dialogues presents a rare chance to immerse yourself in a conversation with some of the most influential thinkers of our time, tackling important topics relating to religion, science, politics, and culture. If you're driven by intellectual honesty, curiosity, and a desire for the truth, Dissident Dialogues is the place for you. Buy your tickets now at dissidentdialogues.org and be part of the conversation. Dissident Dialogues. It's not just an event, it's an intellectual journey. And now back to the Quillette podcast. When we talk about Kendi, I guess he's so famous we can just use one name, but we're obviously talking about Ibram X. Kendi. Until reading this book, I actually didn't know how loony some of his arguments were. You describe an article he wrote in Politico where he wanted the United States to create an anti-racism czar or some kind of committee whose members could not be fired by the executive and would have the power to like veto any legislation if they thought it was racist. It strikes me as kind of weird that Politico published that. However, I should say that as I was reading your book, some of the craziest stuff like that, a lot of it was clustered around 2020 and 2021, when there was, because of the murder of George Floyd, you did have a lot of extreme stuff like that. White people washing the feet of black people in public, New York Times publishing some crazy op-eds. You talk about Yale University's Child Study Center brought in a psychiatrist, Aruna Kilanani, and her presentation, like she didn't try and hide it, her presentation was called The Psychopathic Problem of the White Mind. And then she gives this presentation where she rhapsodizes about killing people. Obviously, some of the ideas you're discussing are still very popular now, but would you say that that initial flourishing of, call it neo-racist radicalism, really did crest in 2020?
It peaked in 2020 and 2021 as a result of the death of George Floyd, the public outpouring of grief and sorrow and rage in response to that. However, it was a trend that had been trending upwards since 2013.
And we'll get into why that's the case, because you have a very interesting analysis about why. We'll get into that in a bit.
But yeah, it's certainly fallen from a peak since 2021. But to say it's fallen from a peak is not to say we're in a good place about it. I mean, as I think I've said before, if you were in 1946, you could say, you know, violence, global violence has peaked. But that wouldn't necessarily mean the world was a very peaceful place or that you were in a good spot. It just means it was recently worse than it's ever been.
Reading your book, I got the sense either you're an extremely self-aware person about how your ideas can be attacked and have been attacked, and or you had a very smart group of readers who read your manuscript and pointed out possible counterarguments, because there are several points in the book where you stop and say, look, I want to be very clear, I'm not arguing this, and I want to acknowledge this. So one of those points is where you talk about colorblindness. Could you explain for our listeners the difference between the kind of individual-based civil rights approach you have to the issue of race and the idea of complete colorblindness, as that term is sometimes used to set up a straw man argument against your type of argument?
Yeah, the caricature of colorblindness is that it's just pretending not to see race. And if you pretend not to see race, or if you really are truly colorblind and literally can't see race, then people argue you can't see racism.
Although from your book, I learned that clinically colorblind people can actually distinguish black and white people.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you have red-green colorblindness, you could easily tell that I'm not white. Yeah. Anyway, some defenders of colorblindness have set up a very convenient target for enemies of colorblindness by using the phrase, I don't see race. The other side can simply say, well, actually, you do see race. So stop pretending you don't. And that's a powerful argument, which is why my version of colorblindness is not to pretend you don't see race. We all see race. And more than that, we're all capable of being racially biased in theory, right? And we should all be aware of that possibility. Colorblindness, I argue, is trying your best to not treat people according to their race, to not treat people differently as a result of their race, to interrogate that not only within yourself, but also to demand that of the state.
On the surface, being an anti-racist should mean that you're downplaying the importance of race, which I think you do in good faith in this book. Race is boring. It doesn't define us. Let's move on and talk about other things. But you, and I'll quote here, the hallmark of believing something is a social construct is taking that social construct less seriously, relaxing the rules and norms surrounding it. Neo-racists do just the opposite. They police the rules of race with a zeal that they could not possibly have if they really believed it was just a social construct, which rings true to me, but you're essentially accusing them of intellectual dishonesty here. Now we're maybe going beyond the realm of, oh, it's all well-intentioned.
I don't think it's intentional because I think people can live in contradiction. I think they think it's a social construct, but their behavior doesn't match that belief, right? Who are the people in society most likely to get up in arms about the fact that a person with white skin owns a Mexican restaurant? Well, it's not Mexicans, really. It's not your average Mexican that is likely to get mad at that fact. In fact, if it's good Mexican food, they're likely to be flattered. The people that are likely to get mad are elite anti-racists that have this particular neo-racist philosophy. Who are the people most likely to get mad that a white girl wears a prom dress with a Chinese pattern? It's not Chinese people. Certainly it's not Chinese people in China. It's not Chinese immigrants that have just arrived on our shores. They're likely to find that amusing and flattering and to have a warm reaction to that. The people likely to say, well, you're white, you shouldn't be wearing Asian clothes, are the same people who say race totally isn't real and is a social construct. That's a contradiction that they have to reconcile. My argument is that if we say that race is a social construct, then we ought to live that way. We ought to relax the rules and norms surrounding it and not complain so much about these sort of fake issues like cultural appropriation. And so we just saw at the Grammys, Luke Combs performing Tracy Chapman's old song, Fast Car, with Tracy Chapman. Great performance. Everyone loved it. Luke Combs fans got to see Tracy Chapman. Tracy Chapman fans got to be introduced to Luke Combs. He is white. And she obviously got paid, I think, handsomely for his cover of her song. Her song was a hit then, but his song, I think, is an even bigger hit. Everyone was happy with this scenario. No one was offended. Neither Tracy Chapman nor Luke Combs had any problems, and it was a totally positive moment until a few writers had to make the obligatory argument that he was a white man taking a black woman's song, and that why is his song such a big hit when Tracy Chapman's version wasn't quite as big a hit, though it was a hit. Obviously, it's a ridiculous argument on so many levels. First of all, there's been nothing more normal in American music than for artists of one race to do another artist of another race's song. I mean, that's been happening since recorded music started. How many of the old jazz standards sung by Billie Holiday or Ella Fitzgerald or Nat King Cole were written by white or Jewish songwriters? Like, arguably most of them, right? Nobody thought that that was weird. And if they did, you know, you'd be laughed out of the room for complaining that Nat King Cole stole a song from a Jewish musician by doing a cover of it.
You talk about how Michael Bernstein, a sociologist, found that 55% of college students in his studied sample agreed with at least one of three quotes from Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf once he swapped out the words Jewish and white. As much as I found it disturbing, I also thought, well, it kind of makes sense. Like, if you're going to talk about whiteness as this, like, conniving ethos of greed and self-advancement and exploitation, that is kind of the way old-school anti-Semitism was, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the anti-whiteness rhetoric, it's just the classic anti-Semitic playbook, but swapping Jews for white people in general. That's kind of the genesis of that Bernstein study, is that observation.
At least in Canada, where I live, you sometimes hear people drawing these arcane distinctions between whiteness and actual white people. And they say, no, we're not talking about actual white people. We're talking about this ethos called whiteness, which is this evil ethos. Is that something you've heard in the United States, or is that just something we talk about in Canada?
That's a BS argument that people fall back on when they don't want to own their bigotry. Can you imagine this in reverse? Can you imagine if someone said, when I say that blackness means laziness or blackness means criminality, I'm not talking about black people. I'm just talking about blackness. How would that go over with the black community? Would they say, oh, that seems reasonable. He's not talking about us. He's just talking about our essence. No, it's absolutely absurd to expect someone to distinguish between black people and blackness, or white people and whiteness, or Asian people and Asianness, or Jewish people and Jewishness.
As much as we attack cancel culture and social media and stuff, is it possible social media, we'll talk about the negative effects in a bit, but there has been a positive thing in calling out the extremism in progressive circles through the traditional tools that originally had been weaponized by people who promote call-out culture?
Social media is behind this whole trend to begin with. So the fact that people are also using social media to fight it is kind of unsurprising and masks that social media is the source of the problem. Pretty much every year from 2000 until 2013, the number of Black people who said bias was a big issue went down every single year, essentially. Then in 2013, trends reverse. So the question is, what happened in 2013? It wasn't Obama and it wasn't Trump. It was something else. And I argue that it was the fact that a critical mass of people had two pieces of technology, camera-enabled smartphones and social media. And that changes how information spreads, how quickly information spreads, and therefore changes what information we receive. So in, say, in 2005, if a police officer is arresting a Black suspect and that police officer is white and something goes horribly wrong, you might hear about that on the local news the next day. Maybe it makes your local news, maybe it makes your local newspaper. And when it hits the newspaper, it's surrounded by journalistic context. Let's say that same thing happens now in 2013, 2014. What happens is probably someone was there to film it, and they probably started filming right when the interaction went left, therefore leaving out everything that led up to the incident. They've posted it on Facebook as an out-of-context clip, and it's gotten millions of views within hours. That is a fundamental change in the way information spreads and in the kind of information that gets to your brain. And it's all preferentially boosted by algorithms that show you the things that are going to make you most angry, because anger equals engagement. So you basically have a fundamental change in the kind of information that we experience. And that's the direct cause, in my view, of the Black Lives Matter movement, of the myth that it was open season on police killing unarmed Black people. And everything we've talked about with respect to neo-racism and cancellations is all downstream of that.
You wrote your book, obviously, before the current conflict in Gaza, before the Hamas terrorist attacks and then the Israeli invasion of Gaza. But I can tell you that among my friends who are Zionists, there was a period, and some are still doing it, that all they did, they were just watching this stuff on their phone, getting themselves worked up about it. And then other people who are more passionate about Palestinian rights, it was the same thing. They were also glued to their phone, but they were being radicalized on the other side. You know, this plays into some of the material you have in your book about the maybe inescapably tribal nature of the human brain. What solution is there for that?
I'm not sure if there is a solution, but I think there are things we can do. One thing we can hope for is that as technology evolves, culture evolves with it, and that we develop norms of not jumping to assumptions based on video clips. Another thing is community notes model on Twitter is working better than any other attempts at fact-checking I've seen, in the sense that when someone says something really misleading on Twitter, rather than fact-check it, you crowdsource a community context note, and those context notes are 9 times out of 10 very helpful to you understanding how what's being said might be misleading. I've seen it done by the right and the left. There are people like Jonathan Haidt that have thought about the micro solutions much more than I have. In general, you know, staying off our phones more of the time, I think, would be a good thing. Phone-free classrooms seems to me a no-brainer.
Everybody I know talks about you on social media, but you yourself are not a huge user of social media, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, you're not the first person to say that. I think I don't use Twitter as much as I used to. I think using Twitter is not the most pleasant experience. I'm not a person that wants to live my life online. I look at what's happening far more than I comment, and I try less and less to just be reactive and jumping on whatever is the latest thing, because it's less satisfying to live that way, in my view.
You have an interesting analogy where you talk about, it's kind of a thought experiment, you talk about people who are trying to solve the problem of all this hostility between Yankee fans and Red Sox fans. And you say, well, you know, the imagined response would be, oh, let's just talk about baseball in general and how important baseball is and how amazing baseball is. But then you say, well, that's probably going to make the problem worse, because if all you're doing is talking about the amazingness and existential importance of baseball, then people are going to be like, well, yeah, that's exactly why it's like so important that people hate the Yankees and love the Red Sox or vice versa. And you kind of make an analogy to race. But isn't your life kind of a little bit, I guess, by necessity, lived in a kind of contradictory state, since because you have this argument to make against how fixated people are on race, you yourself have to talk about race, because you can't argue against that idea without talking about race. And Race is in the title of your book. It's called The End of Race Politics. Is your ultimate goal that you're not going to have to write books like this and people talk about race less and your next book is going to be about music?
Well, I don't really value books about music all that much, although I do like Ted Gioia. Ted Gioia is a really great music writer. So yeah, my next book definitely wouldn't be about music. As I say, writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
That's a good line.
But yeah, I mean, it's only a seeming paradox. For instance, is it a paradox that an atheist like Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins has spent so much time talking about God, right? Well, it's only a seeming paradox because they live in a society where most people believe in God and they think there is no God, probably, and that the whole idea of God's importance is a myth and a pernicious one. So how are they going to convey that message other than to talk a lot about the idea of God? So if I'm going to argue that race is not a significant attribute, and I live in a society where a lot of people think it is, I'm going to have to spend a lot of time talking about the idea of race in order to convey why it's less important and why we should view it as less important and less real than many people do.
Coleman Hughes is the author of The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Coleman, thanks so much for being on the Quillette Podcast.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Quillette Podcast. Quillette is where free thought lives. We are an independent, grassroots platform for heterodox ideas and fearless commentary. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going to quillette.com and becoming a paid subscriber. This subscription will also give you access to all our articles and early access to Quillette social events.